The second case for oral argument this morning is New Leaf and Others Appellants versus FD Development and Family Dollar Stores of South Dakota, Appalese. For the appellants, we have Mr. John Nooney and Mr. Aaron Galloway, attorneys from Rapid City. And I understand Mr. Nooney will be presenting this morning. All right. For the Appalese FD Development, we have Rodney Schlager and Eric Picker, attorneys from Rapid City. And Jason Smiley. I understand Mr. Schlager will be speaking for 10 minutes and then Mr. Picker for 10 minutes.
That is correct, yes.
Very well. And then, Mr. Nooney, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Nooney. I'm here today on behalf of the appellants, Mr. and Mrs. Robert Dvorak, as well as New Leaf. This case involves a relatively simple principle called equity. I think a few salient facts are important for us to remember before we dive into the issues that are before this court. Back in 1982, my clients bought a small grocery store business out in Black Hawk, South Dakota. Now, the Black Hawk, South Dakota has grown over the last 28 years now. They bought that business, and through a course of time, they bought a business, then they bought some real property, and as many family businesses in South Dakota take off, at some point after my clients had had the property for some time, they decided to sell the business, I stress the business, to their son and daughter-in-law. That happened in the mid-1990s. Shortly after that, my clients, Mr. and Mrs. Robert Dvorak, went out and bought a 20-acre parcel of adjoining property. And they bought that for the purposes of developing that property. But recognizing at this point in time, there were 12-plus years or 13 years into this process of growing this small little grocery business they had started out in basically rural South Dakota at the time. Black Hawk was just a little stop on the road, so to speak. They bought this 20-acre parcel of land, and they platted that property into 19 acres. And at the time they did that, they had specific thoughts of making certain that they were not going to be inundated with a potential competitor. The trial transcript talks about the specific facts that they were concerned that Nash Finch, one of the largest grocers in the western South Dakota area, would not come out and buy up any of their property and put a competing business right next to their small family grocery store. So back in 1995, when they bought this adjoining property, they specifically put a covenant on that property, which addressed many areas like covenants typically do in the state of South Dakota, speaking of waste and animals and things such as that. But there was a specific covenant that they put in place that was intended to protect their business and their investment on a going forward basis, that no groceries should be sold in any of this adjoining 20-acre parcel. That happened in 1995. In 2006, Mr. and Mrs. Robert Dvorak sold to their son, Ray, and his wife, Bobby, the real estate which accompanied that small family grocery store that they had started back in the 1980s. This happened in early 2006. And therein lies the beginning of the problem that brings us today to Pierce, South Dakota to talk to this court. In December of 2006, one of my law partners, Kurt Soleil, authored a letter and sent that letter to FD Development. That letter was sent 3 years and 10 months ago today. And in that letter, Mr. Soleil very succinctly informed FD Development that being the entity who was apparently embarking upon the construction of a building that was going to be leased to Family Dollar. And they were specifically told of the covenants that were recorded on the subject property that FD Development had purchased, and were specifically told and reminded of the covenants that had been recorded some 10 or 11 years prior to that. That was in December of 2006. In February of 2007, on the adjoining property, which was the subject of the covenants that had been on record for more than 12 years, Family Dollar opened up a competing business on the property, which was immediately adjacent to and next door to the small family grocery store that was operated by Dvorak. A lawsuit was commenced in February of 2007, when on behalf of the Dvoraks and other interested parties, a request was made of the trial judge, Judge Eckridge, and a complaint was filed for the entry of a permanent injunction, enjoining the property, which was owned by FD Development and under leased to Family Dollar, to prevent them from selling groceries in their store. It's not as though Family Dollar or FD Development were not well aware of the covenants prior to them opening their door in February of 2007. As I mentioned earlier, in 1995, when the property was purchased, the covenants were properly recorded, and no one has ever suggested they were not properly recorded with the Meade County Register of Deeds Office. In April of 2006, when one of the managing members of the FD Development Group signed a letter of intent to Family Dollar, they specifically represented to Family Dollar that there were no covenants or restrictions on the property. In May of 2006, before purchasing the property, FD Development obtained a title policy from a local title company. And in that title policy, as one would expect, there was specific language, or specific exceptions, I should say, which identified the covenants which had been on record since March of 1995. In August of 2006, FD Development and Family Dollar entered into a lease agreement. And as one of the conditions of that lease agreement, there was a specific prohibition that Family Dollar, recognizing what their business was all about, there was a representation by FD Development, the owner of the property, that in the property that we have purchased and which we are developing for purposes of leasing to you, that there are not any, no restrictive covenants that would prohibit your operation of your business. It's not as if FD Development did not have a prior relationship with Family Dollar. FD Development's business, some part of their business model was the developing of small stores which were going to be leased to Family Dollar. It's important to note that Family Dollar, the entity that leased the store, had no obligation to FD Development, no obligation until he took possession of the store. And in February of 2007, when Family Dollar took possession of that store, everybody was well aware of the fact that there was a outstanding dispute as to the covenants that specifically restricted and prohibited the sale of groceries in that location. The case moved forward after it had been filed in February of 2007. And in April of 2008, now more than a year and several months thereafter, the trial court entered a decision on the respective cross motions for summary judgment. In that decision, the trial court specifically acknowledged that the covenant that was the subject of the litigation was valid. They found that Robert and Vivian Dvorak had standing to pursue this claim, as did New Leaf Development. They initially decided that the covenants did not constitute an inappropriate restraint of trade, but it's appropriate for the record to note that the trial judge, after making that decision of April 2008, and prior to the time that the case was then tried in February of 2009, the court revisited that issue and said, that may involve factual questions that I may need to hear evidence on. So the question of whether or not there had been a restraint of trade, the court left that issue open. And then the court decided on the ultimate question before it, that it said as a matter of fact, it could not make a decision as to whether or not injunctive relief was appropriate. Remembering that this was at the time that the court was dealing with the cross motions for summary judgment. But it's important to note that while the court back in the preliminary stages of this case made a determination that it could not decide whether or not injunctive relief, what the court basically had done was this. This court is well aware of the factors that this court has set forth that must be considered when determining whether injunctive relief is appropriate. The trial court took itself through the process and assessed and analyzed the four factors that had to be considered and made some findings relative to those factors. The court found that the party to be enjoined, FD Development and Family Dollar, had caused the damage. The court made a specific finding to that. The court found that, yes, irreparable harm would result without the entry of the injunction due to the lack of an adequate remedy at law. The court found that the party to be enjoined, Family Dollar and FD Development, had acted in bad faith. But the court left open the question of whether or not, in balancing the equities between the party moving for the injunction and the party to be enjoined, whether or not the respective gain and benefit associated with that in the balance and the equities, the court said that decision had to be left to the time of the trial. So we proceeded to trial in February of 2009. We are now more than 2 years after the filing of this claim or request for injunctive relief. The court identified three issues that it was going to entertain testimony on to be at the time of trial. First, whether a permanent injunction should be granted. Two, what were groceries? Three, whether or not the covenant constituted an inappropriate restraint on trade. We went through a trial process, and the record, I think, is pretty clear. Unfortunately, when you read the court's, with all due respect to the trial judge, when you read the court's findings of fact, and the court's conclusion of law, they are not reconcilable. You cannot reconcile what the court's found as a matter of fact in the case and what it ultimately concluded in the case. Let's start with the issue of groceries. Remembering that one of the three issues that the trial court had said had to be addressed was the question of what were groceries. The court made some specific findings because Family Dollar, like most businesses, have departments where they identify and categorize certain goods that they sell within their store. And in the course of the testimony, it was clearly established there were four different departments that had grocery type items. There was never any dispute about that. In fact, we even had readings of the, I think they're called UPC codes, identifying all of the different goods that were categorized under Department 12, Department 14, Department 27, and Department 30, all which constituted groceries. But in light of the fact that the trial judge found, after the trial in this matter, that Family Dollar made significant monies on the sale of groceries, the court came to the conclusion that it didn't know what groceries were. Well, there was specific testimony as to what groceries were. Family Dollar isn't a competing mom-and-pop business. Family Dollar is a Fortune 500 company that, at the time of trial, had gross sales of approximately $7 billion. And this entity, they had gross sales of $7 billion, had specifically violated the covenant that had been in place since 1985, which specifically restricted the sale of groceries. The trial judge also made, on the question of whether or not the covenants were valid, the trial judge had previously decided that the covenants were specifically valid and that they ran with the land. In the court's trial decision, even though it wasn't a matter to be resolved by the trial judge, the court makes findings about these being personal to Mr. and Mrs. Robert DeVore. The court goes down the path of trying to balance the equities because that was the ultimate question that was before the court. Is injunctive relief appropriate? Well, the court had previously found when assessing looking at the different elements as to whether or not damage party to be enjoined had caused the damage. The trial judge, in its memorandum decision back in April of 2008, had specifically made a finding that, yes, the party to be enjoined, Family Dollar and FT Development, had caused the damage. But then the court then retracts its previous finding and says, but I don't know that there's really been any damage because we can't identify any monetary loss. This court has said on repeated occasions that the purpose of injunctive relief is in those situations where damages are not practical to calculate. And in a situation like this, that's exactly what we had. We had a situation where someone had put a covenant in place, and the ability to calculate what those damages were was going to be very difficult. Although, of course, there was testimony at the time of trial that the current operator of the family grocery business on the subject property had recognized a significant decline in revenues and sales, significant decline in the number of customer counts. But the trial judge, for some reason, had found or had retraced its own steps and had made some finding that I don't think the party to be enjoined had caused damage because there's been no damages proven in this case, when without any doubt this court has specifically said Damages need not be established in a case seeking injunctive relief.
Which can you kind of point me? I'm confused as to which court's findings you're referring to or what you're referring to. Can you help me on that?
Your Honor, I certainly can.
Is that the 26th of January one? Or?
Those are the ones, the findings, Justice Myra Henry, the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law that were entered on January 26th of 2010, pardon me.
And then were there some later ones, or is that?
No, those were the ultimate findings that get us to this court today. The court had previously entered this memorandum decision. That memorandum decision had been entered, I believe, in April of 2008.
Okay. So that had different things in it than the findings did?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. Because the court's initial decision in April of 2008 had kind of morphed forward then, if we could use that phrase, until sometime in September of 2008, when specifically this issue and this question of whether or not the court had made a, there had been an inappropriate restraint of trade, that was the issue that kept kind of going forward.
But aren't we bound by his final findings of fact and conclusions of law?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because Judge Eckridge, if you look at the order that was entered by him in September of 2008, he made specific provisions within that order that order was a final and appealable decision. And specifically, the court had done that in a sua sponte fashion in that he had made some decisions. One was the question of whether or not the covenants run with the land, which was significant to my client. And then the other question is whether or not the covenants were valid, which were significant as a concern to the opposing party. And the judge on his own motion made a decision that those findings, those decisions that had been entered by him in his preliminary decision back in April of 2008, that those were going to be final decisions because they were accompanied in an order then that he made those specifically final decisions. And if we were going to appeal them, he told us, of course, we needed to appeal them or we were going to lose them. So basically, he had resolved a good part of the case, leaving three narrow questions to be resolved. Whether or not an injunction should be granted, and the question of whether or not what were groceries, and then whether or not there had been an inappropriate restraint of trade.
All right. One of the things in this that troubled me is, okay, that's a final, or he made that a final order, 54B, but can he then reopen that issue? Aren't there means by which a court can revisit issues? Was there any request that it reopen, or to just do that as part of the final decision?
I'm not sure what he did, because we addressed that in our brief because we're mindful of a decision of this court involving Jackson County, I think it's Weiser versus Jackson County, and pardon me if I'm wrong about that, that there are times prior to that decision that when judges enter 54B final decisions, we as trial lawyers assume they were in fact final. But if you read the brief that is offered by Family Dollar and FD Development, they specifically say, no, those were already decided by the trial judge. And Judge Eckridge at no time during this process ever suggested that there was any reason that his prior decisions needed to be reopened or reconsidered. That was never discussed at any time, Justice Everson. So that was new to us when all of a sudden we get to his new decision, his decision in January of 2010, where he had gone back and revisited these issues which had been specifically addressed by him in his initial decision, specifically addressed by him in an order prior to the time of trial, setting those forth as final decisions.
But you know, unless you can point me to some authority, I'm just not aware of anything that prohibits a trial judge from doing that, even on a 54B certification, unless somebody takes an appeal.
Even if he has the authority to do it, and then you look at the appropriate standard review as it concerns this case, the conclusions that the judge reached, his findings that are reached, you cannot reconcile those with the conclusions of law. For instance, one of the findings he talks about, one of the elements that has to be considered is the party to be enjoined, did he act in bad faith? In one of his findings of fact, specifically, he talks about, he says, Family Dollar and FD Development in conclusion of law number 8, they blithely ignored the fact that this covenant existed. And then he finds that the party, FD Development and Family Dollar had not acted in bad faith. It's almost as if the trial judge had taken the position of looking at bad faith like we do insurance cases. Because if you read the case law from this court, it says, when you look at the third factor, has the party to be enjoined acted in bad faith, or was it an innocent mistake? Well, the record is replete, and the findings of fact are replete with the fact that these covenants were well documented. They had Family Dollar and FD Development had actual and constructive knowledge of the existence. So for him to find that they did not act in bad faith, you can't reconcile that with the findings of fact that he has with the conclusions of law that he has created.
Didn't the court say it was a quote, corporate mistake, unquote?
I think what the court said is, he specifically made the finding, he says in finding of fact number 20, any reasonable competent businessman, land developer, or real estate purchaser knows or should know a pre-closing title search is essential and elementary. So I see my time is done, but if I could finish that answer.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The trial judge found that they acted with reckless disregard, and if I could use this phrase, they ran every stop sign that was in front of them, but I'm not going to say it's bad faith.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nooney.
Thank you.
Mr. Schlager, you have 10 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel, justice. My name is Rod Schlager, and I am on behalf of Eric Picar, representing FD Development Appalachia. I'm a little excited this morning to speak in front of you. I've been an attorney for 20 years, and this is the first opportunity that I've had to have with oral argument. I would like to outline some of the factual elements relevant in this case, and then Mr. Picar will come up and probably make sense of my argument. I want to point out one thing, justices, that the appellant is here today standing before the court as a declarant under the covenants. The record is clear and it's undisputed that the appellants do not own a business that is harmed or impacted by FD Development. The appellants do not own land in the BJD subdivision, the area in which is encompassed by the covenants. They are not a shareholder in Country Stores, Inc., the grocery store outside of the covenants. The court made a finding. The transcript is clear. There are no damages whatsoever suffered by the appellants.
Do they own the land under the store?
No, not at this time, Your Honor.
Okay.
And there are a few more facts that I want the court to be aware of. From July of 2004 through July of 2006, there was the TLC 98-cent store in the BJ subdivision operating. This store sold groceries. They sold canned fruits and vegetables, pickles, ketchup, mustard, paper towels, tissues, vitamins, cleaning products, soaps, candies, cookies, cereal, dog food, Vienna sausages. They sold groceries for 2 years. And that's an important fact, Justices, because our client came to South Dakota to look for a location to open a Family Dollar store, to build and lease to Family Dollar. They went in to this TLC store. They saw that they were selling groceries. They actually bought a pen and paper to take notes. The transcript is clear. They saw this. They also went into the liquor store. The liquor store is selling chips and pops and all sorts of other grocery items. They go to the movie store. They see the movie store selling popcorn and chips, other side grocery items. They had no notice. They had no knowledge that grocery items would be impermissible in this area. And that's an important factor when analyzing this as they go down.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes.
You know, that's a good argument when you get to the last factor, balancing equities and that kind of thing. But how do you reconcile, or how do you explain the fact that, you know, that this is a major company? They're clearly on notice of this covenant. Yet they make an obviously conscious decision to proceed. I mean, how is this different than the Hillswater Development case?
I'm sorry, the what case?
Hillswater Development case.
Okay. First of all, my client, Family Dollar, is not, or FD Development, is a small, closely held corporation. The issue with the notice in particular, in December of 2006, when they received the notice that Mr. Nooney read to you today from Mr. Soleil, they had already signed a letter of intent with Family Dollar for this. But more importantly...
Well, when the FD bought the land, they were told by the title company that this was on there. How can they say they didn't have notice?
That's correct, Justice. And we had actual and constructive notice. But the facts at trial demonstrate, first, that letter giving us notice was sent by Country Stores, Inc., a company that did not own land in the BJD subdivisions. They're not a party to this lawsuit, and I don't want to lose sight of that. But after they found the covenants, their paralegal, Sabrina Oliver, went in and as went into their engineer, Mr. Harrell. He's a Duke grad. He's helped out in all of these things. She said, look, we found this covenant, and it says doesn't allow for the sale of groceries. He looked at that and said, it doesn't matter. It's an FDA regulation, and groceries is defined here, deals with meat and fresh produce. Family Dollar doesn't sell that. It was very clear at the trial. Yes, that was a mistake. They screwed up. But they did not intentionally go forward with that knowledge. And again, that's why you have to look at the fact is that there are three stores selling groceries at the time they're making the inspection. They find out they had, and they do get notice. But also, when that notice was sent in December of 2006, the store, and the record is replete, the store was 70% completed. There's no dispute about that.
Did the trial court make any findings then on waiver or abandonment of rights or anything like that?
The trial court did not find a waiver. The trial court examined each of the elements and determined that that was not a waiver. But in conclusions of law paragraph 8, the court also held that that was not bad faith, but a factor in determining the balancing of the equities. The court looked at everything. The court specifically did not find waiver, though, but balanced the equities in looking at all of those issues. Because you really don't, in this case, Justices, you really don't get to the fourth factor of applying an injunction, though, if you apply the law. The first factor, did the party to be enjoined cause the damages? Again, there's absolutely, unequivocally, no evidence, no finding of damages by these appellants.
Well, doesn't that really lead towards injunctive relief? Because part of the basis for injunctive relief is where damages are difficult or impossible to determine.
That would be true, Justice, but there were no damages. The evidence is that there would be nothing different for the appellants.
There's a violation of a covenant here. The court found that there was a valid covenant. What's the remedy? What's the remedy of the people who have a valid covenant? If it's not injunction, what's their remedy?
Well, that's why you have the four factors, because injunctions is an extraordinary relief, and that the courts look at the balancing of the factors before they issue an injunction. And this first element is damages. Are there damages? There are none. The second factor, would irreparable harm...
Where's the finding that there are no damages? Does he make an actually finding on that?
Yes, the conclusions of law are replete with those findings, going through in particular that there are no findings. There is testimony... There's absolute testimony in the trial transcript 96 that even if Family Dollar closed, the appellants would receive nothing extra. There is a conclusion of law 2F, evidence near closing would actually decrease traffic in the BJD subdivision. It must be noted that there was no owner of land in the BJD subdivision that testified against Family Dollar. On the contrary, all the owners of land that owned land in the BJD subdivision testified in favor of Family Dollar. No owner of land supported closing Family Dollar. The evidence also shows that Family Dollar increased traffic and increased revenue to all of the stores in the BJD subdivision. That evidence is unrefuted regarding that. And again, nobody that owned land testified in favor of closing Family Dollar. If Family Dollar, and then finally looking at balancing the equities on each of these elements, is the party to be enjoined acting in bad faith, or is its injury-causing behavior an innocent mistake? We would posit that it was an innocent mistake going forward. But that's why we have to look at the fact that when they're first out there, and this is over a year period, they come out and inspect this area. They see three stores selling grocery items. That's why there's in conclusions of law number 8, it's not bad faith. And courts held it's not a waiver. But the court looked at these factors altogether, whether or not to enforce an injunction, because it is such an extreme remedy. And finally, in balancing the equities, is the hardship to be suffered by the enjoined disproportionate to the benefits to be gained? If an injunction is issued, the record is clear. Family Dollar will close this store. 4 people will lose its jobs. Traffic in this area, business traffic, will decrease. And my client, Family Dollar, is left with an empty store and a $620,000 mortgage. Conversely, there would be no change to the appellants. The record is clear. No change to the appellants.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Picard, you have 10 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. Several issues I want to touch on that were brought up during Mr. Schlager's argument. In regard to the findings, Justice Meyer Henry, you look at finding of fact 51 and 52, you will see that the court made specific findings that there were no damages to be suffered by the appellants. It also made a specific finding in regard to the other appellant, New Leaf LLC. That's finding of fact number 7. It found that this party is not affected either way. It's a straw man. Played no role at the trial, not even to be considered. Justice Simpson, you asked how this case was different than Hills Water and Development. Entirely distinguishable. That case dealt with a residential subdivision. There was a rendering company there. They're actually seeking to get it declared a nuisance. All the property owners in the area came to the trial and testified, this is a nuisance, there's noise, there's dust, this is a big issue. This wasn't a residential area. This is a subdivision developed for business. And none of the other property owners showed up to voice their displeasure with it. Contrarily, they showed up and said, don't shut this place down. This has increased business, or increased traffic to my business. And it would negatively affect us if you did shut it down. So not only were there no property owners at the trial testifying against it, the only owners of property within the BJD subdivision that showed up to the trial said, we're in favor of it.
I was asking about, more specifically, about the law of those who intentionally violate, violate.
Very good. This court has said that the trial court can use its discretion as to whether or not it even gets to the balancing of the equities if there is a knowing and willful violation. It's up to the discretion of the trial court. In this case, the court exercised its discretion to look at that last factor, although really it didn't even need to. As Mr. Schlager pointed out, the trial court made very specific conclusions of law regarding the first, the second, and the third factor, all of which ruled in favor of the appellant. The fourth factor really is irrelevant. Don't even need to look at it. But the court did. It exercised its discretion in looking at that factor and also found in favor of the FD Development and Family Dollar on that issue as well. Mr. Nooney talked about the definition of groceries and how the court made a finding regarding that it was overbroad. That finding is irrelevant. Because the court determined that the injunction was not to issue, there was no need to make a specific finding on the definition of groceries. Now it did. And it stated that the definition, the term groceries was overbroad, which subjected it to a whimsical application and arbitrary enforcement. But that wasn't the only factor that the trial court relied upon. It was one of the 28 findings of fact, 28 conclusions of law, 53 findings of fact. conclusion of Law 2 has subparts A through I, which is how we get to that number. So it wasn't solely relied upon, and it was basically, it didn't even need to be decided, and it wasn't relied upon as the sole reason for the trial court's decision. I also want to touch on Mr. Nooney's reference to the final order issued on December 8th. That's been attached to appellant's brief as Appendix D, and that's the judgment of dismissal in order denying motion for relief of judgment. This is really important. The only aspect of the any decision prior to the trial that was made a final order or attempted to be made a final order, regardless of whether or not the trial court can actually do that, was the issue of standing as it applied to the parties. That's the only issue that was made final. No other aspect of that memorandum decision was addressed with this final order. The 54B applied only to the standing of the parties. And that was a very important distinction that I wanted to address.
So did, what in the final analysis, was this, did it run with the land or was it personal?
Irrelevant. The court looked at the, at whether or not an injunction should issue here. And the court found that it shouldn't. And it looked at the four factors that have been delineated by this court time and time again when discussing what a trial court should look at in exercising its discretion as to whether or not a permanent injunction should ensue. Four factors were looked at. This is what it really boils down to, is did the trial court abuse its, in fact, this is what our issue number one is, did the trial court abuse its discretion in denying the plaintiff's request for a permanent injunction? Nothing else matters. That is the true issue here. And the trial court clearly stated in conclusion of law number five, here are the four factors, as have been delineated by the South Dakota Supreme Court. Conclusion of law number six went through factor number one. Conclusion of law number seven went through factor number two. Conclusion of law eight, three, and again, conclusion of law number nine went through the fourth factor. And it found in favor of the appellee on all four factors. So when the appellants state in their brief that the court implied an improper analysis, I fail to see how that's possible. The very factors that were stated were analyzed one by one by the trial court in this matter. I think the most analogous case to this situation is Hartson v. Pesca. If you look at that, in fact, that's the only case we cite in our most relevant cases in authority. It's very analogous factually and legally. In that case, we have an individual who purchased some land. He was advised that he was not to build a cabin on this land. He mistakenly relied upon the representations made to him by his realtor and the surveyor. They're like, go ahead, you can build your property, or you can build this cabin on this property. Those covenants don't apply to you. He received a letter from Harkson, a neighboring property owner, and Harkson's attorney saying, there's covenants here. You cannot build this cabin. He proceeded. He was sued. He completed construction of his cabin. Went to the trial court. The trial court found that he had violated it and then actually issued a mandatory injunction that he should rip it down. Upon applying for relief to this court, the Supreme Court found, look, in applying the balancing of the equities, the injunction is simply too harsh here. We're not going to make him tear down his cabin because you can barely see the cabin from the edge of Harkson's land. All right, so there's no real damage to him. And the Supreme Court said that you should consider the opinions of the neighboring landowners. Well, no one else showed up to the trial to object to it. And that's what we have here. In fact, in our case, the neighboring landowner showed up and said, don't shut down Family Dollar. And, you know, that's an important consideration.
There was always injunctive relief sought, not any damages. There was never any damages.
Initially, I believe damages were sought, and I believe an agreement was, forgive me, I don't recall exactly how that was handled, but I believe initially damages were sought. But there are no damages here. Not only are there no damages, but there's no benefit to the only remaining parties should the injunction ensue. And my partner misspoke briefly. We represent FD Development. FD Development is separate from Family Dollar. Family Dollar, yes, they are a Fortune 500 company. FD Development is not. And if this store is closed, that's going to severely handicap their business. They'll be stuck with a vacant building. It's been established that Family Dollar will shut down. They will terminate the lease and they'll move out. FD Development, our client, will be stuck with a large building and a large mortgage payment with no income from lease payments in order to take care of that. That's a significant damage. They are the only party who would truly be damaged in this matter if an injunction were to ensue. The only party. Obviously, Family Dollar would suffer as well, but the appellants and the plaintiffs, there are no damages, and there is no benefit. And I think that that flows with the Hartson v. Pesca analysis. But also importantly, it flows with the first two factors that this court is to consider in making a determination as to whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in deciding an injunction issue. Unless the court has any further questions for me, I have nothing further to state at this time.
Is FD Development a parent company of Family Dollar?
Absolutely not. FD Development is entirely separate from Family Dollar. The owner of FD Development is a man by the name of Jay Mocklad. It's a small company out of Alabama. What they do is they purchase properties like this, and then they try to lease them to Family Dollar or other chain stores of that nature. So they are.
I assume that the FD stands for Family Dollar. Is that wrong assumption?
That's why he named it that. He has different corporations that he creates for the purpose of building this. So this one was FD Development, Family Dollar Development, separate and apart from his main company, which is Venture LLC.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Picard.
Thank you.
Mr. Nooney, you have 10 minutes, sir.
As I listen to Mr. Picard and Mr. Slaugher, it's almost as if they would have this court find that because people like to have the Family Dollar store there, and it's a popular location, but that's reason enough to set aside the validity and the purpose of the covenant that was put in place in 1985. And I don't believe that this court has ever said that before. I don't think there's any written opinion from the South Dakota Supreme Court that says, well, because people like the fact that the covenant isn't being followed and there's some benefit that we are ancillarily receiving from that, but that's the reason why a covenant should not be enforced. This court has specifically laid down some very specific findings as to how and why injunctive relief is appropriate. Several of the justices have specifically asked the questions about damages. And this court has written in repeated decisions that damages need not exist because they may not exist when people are here in equity asking for injunctive relief. When you go through the test as to whether or not injunctive relief is appropriate, back in 1975, I think it was, this court wrote a decision in Foley versus City of Yankton, which I think when you go through the four factors, remembering that the first three factors had been addressed by the court initially, but you get to that fourth factor, and the court has specifically said that the court, the trial court, will not balance equities where the actions of the defendant were taken willfully and with full knowledge of the plaintiff's rights and the consequences which might ensue. What this court said in 1975 was that when you go through the four factors to be considered when determining whether or not injunctive relief is appropriate, you need not even concern yourself with that fourth factor about the benefits for some and the detriments of others. Because when people have blown through every stop sign that's presented to them, it's not appropriate for them in a case of equity to come to a trial judge and say, well, yeah, we knew the covenant was there. We had constructive knowledge of it because it was recorded. We saw it in the title policy before we bought the land. We bought the land. We made representations to a tenant that we, being Family Dollar, that we lease properties to all over the country. Even though we represented that we weren't any restrictions, don't mind us because we just made now the third mistake that we've made. And then before the store opens, one of my partners sends a letter to them and say, hey, by the way, we trust you aren't going to be selling any groceries in this location. And they, again, they just plow forward and go through that four stop sign without any regard. And then they come to the trial judge, and then they come to this court and say, South Dakota Supreme Court, we relied upon a Duke engineering graduate as if that has some significance to the question of what groceries were.
The same paralegal that said I relied upon those Duke engineering graduates said, man, I'm getting fired for this thing because I should have picked up on that. So they plow forward, and then they want this court and they wanted the trial court to say that woe is us because now we're going to have a store that we won't have a tenant anymore.
But I read that the court did consider that. I mean, are you saying the court just ignored that or what?
This is my opinion. I'm not saying the court ignored it. But
I mean, what you're asking us to do is ignore the rest of the findings and the other factors and only center on that one.
No, I'm not asking you to center on that. What I'm asking you to do is this, is I think under the Foley decision, I think there's precedent from this court that you don't ever get to that fourth factor, make a determination as to whether or not you balance the good and bad between the parties. All I'm saying is that when you look at this, they want to focus upon the fact that, well, there were a lot of mistakes that happened and we're not really accountable for that. And think about how bad this is going to be, that we're going to have a mortgage to pay. That isn't a consideration for this court, I'm suggesting, under that fourth factor, because you don't have to balance the equities. And I'm not asking this court to disregard all of the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, but the troubling part of the court's trial court's decision is found when you read, for instance, finding of fact number 47. The trial court writes, there was no evidence was presented at the juncture of the case that the restrictive covenant tended to substantially restrict competition in the relevant market. In fact, Judge Eckers goes on to say, the relevant market was never established. But that finding of fact goes to the specific conclusion of law as whether or not there was an inappropriate restraint of trade. Then if you go to Judge Eckers' 18th conclusion of law, he says, after telling us the market area was never defined, there was no evidence that it substantially restricted competition, the trial court writes, the covenant unreasonably restrains trade and unreasonably restrains alienability. You can't reconcile those two. Those are completely opposite things that the trial court has just told us. He's told us that Family Dollar and FD Development don't define the market area. They don't give us any of the factors to support or restrain a trade. But then he finds that the covenant inappropriately restrains trade. What we're here asking this court to do today is this. Equity allows for the granting of injunctive relief. If there was ever a case where injunctive relief is appropriate, now 3 years and 10 months after the sending of a letter to FD Development is, the trial court's decision needs to be reversed with directions that the covenant was valid and it must be enforced and injunctive relief.
Your clients have nothing, as I understand it, your clients have nothing to gain by enforcing this covenant. You're basically saying, what I hear you saying is, they broke the law, they ignored the rules, and we want our covenant enforced, even if we have nothing to gain by it, and they're going to lose a lot by it. Isn't that what equity's about? It's like looking at the law and saying, wait a minute, we don't want a Dickensian result here. We want to do justice. And your clients get nothing out of this except the satisfaction of saying, well, we told you so, so therefore you're out of here.
Justice Kornkamp, with all due respect, I think if that's the approach the court takes, what basically happens is you vitiate the whole purpose of a covenant. For instance, if Walmart buys a piece of property in one of the outlots, there's a covenant that you can't sell groceries on that property. And somebody moves the store and tries to sell groceries there. Well, Walmart's never going to come to here and say, well, look how we've been damaged. We're the largest corporation in the world, but they don't have the same rights to enforce a covenant that someone else has. And the whole purpose of covenants is you have to have the right to enforce that, regardless of whether or not there's any damages. As Justice Severson said, in equity and in injunctive relief, quite often there aren't any damages. So it's not as if we can say, well, how much is Family Dollar going to be damaged, or FD Development, versus how much are we going to gain over here? We can't do that because injunctive relief implicitly says you can't measure the damages. So you don't know what the damages are going to be. And if nothing else, it's the purpose of what covenants are for, to enforce a certain right. It's no different than if someone has a covenant on a housing development that says, we're not going to allow any blue houses. Well, I like blue. Does that mean that Mr. Slaughter, who lives in the same neighborhood, can't come and say, Mr. Nooney, you can't have a blue house? Well, how have you been damaged?
It's like Hargson versus Pexa. I mean, the complainant can say, well, I can see the guy's chimney from here, and the covenant was supposed to protect me from having to see anybody's chimney, or in your case, having to see a blue house. But your client can't even say that. They can't say, we've lost anything. They're not offended in any way by this, because they're still going to get their checks, and that's all they're entitled to.
But the purpose, going back to 1985 where that land was bought, was to allow a development opportunity, but to specifically prohibit the likes of Nash Finch and other grocers from going out there into this new, bustling little community called Blackhawk and putting up a grocery store to compete with a family business. So at the end of the day, the reason why there's no damages are because Ray DeVore, the man and wife, Ray and Bobby, who bought this property in January of 2006, there was specific testimony in the record that said, if I had known that covenant was not enforceable, I would have never bought the land. So he has a continuing obligation to his parents. It's his parents' retirement. That's their livelihood or how they're going to get paid. Ray DeVore talks about the fact that his sales have gone down 20, 30, 40%. His customer count was gone down.
But they're not plaintiffs here, are they?
No, they're not, Justice. But he still has an obligation to figure out how he's going to make his mortgage payment. That's a continuing obligation that he has, regardless of how much money is coming in the till. He has an obligation. He has an obligation to go forward and continue to pay that. And the parents are still getting paid. But the whole purpose of injunctive relief is it's not as if it says, well, you only get enforced this covenant if you can prove you've suffered certain monetary damages. We all know that's not what the law is. And at the end of the day here, we're asking equity. We're asking this court to enforce the right to injunctive relief, to recognize the validity of the covenant, which Judge Eckridge acknowledged, but then he vitiated that right when he set everything aside. We respectfully ask that this court reverse the trial court's decision. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Nooney. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.